When I was growing up, my mother used to tell me, you can do anything, but you can't do everything. There's an illusion, a myth, that exists in our society about a person who does it all. No one does it all. Even the most successful people have to make sacrifices somewhere. Maybe they don't spend as much time with their families as they would want to, or they've neglected their physical or mental well-being in the name of the hustle. But every moment affords us choice. What we eat, what we say, who we spend time with, and how we spend that time. When I first met Rachel Caggiano, she was in the midst of making a new choice. And in the short time I've known her, she's made quite a few more. I asked her to chat with me for this podcast so I could learn not only why her choices are so important to her, but to also discuss the privilege of choice and how we can help create the space and freedom for everyone to choose what is right for them. It's the next episode of Don't Talk to Me About Work. And of course, it's called Choice. What is your earliest childhood memory of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I don't think I ever knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, like a lot of other kids were like, oh, I'm going to be an astronaut, or I'm going to be a doctor or a scientist or something like that. I don't recall ever having like a very, very clear idea of what I wanted to do when I grew up.
So what, when you were growing up, did the adults in your life ever ask you, like, was there any sort of encouragement like, Rachel, you need to pick a job now?
Not necessarily. So my upbringing was very religious and very much like a closed churchy group. And I feel like most of the messaging I was getting was that, like, of course I was going to be, when I grew up, I was going to get married and be a mother and be a great housewife. But there was also, I loved books and I loved reading. And I think deep down, I felt like if I could get a good job or figure out what my career was going to be, that it was a way of escaping this destiny of being like a preacher's wife or a housewife or, you know, a godly woman who wears like long jean skirts and pops out many children.
So did you try and focus on school then?
Yes. Like, I loved school. I loved getting A pluses. I loved getting perfect scores on my tests. I loved studying. I loved memorizing all the spelling words. I loved reading and got just a lot of joy out of learning. It kind of came to a head when I was going to college. And then I was like, well, I'm just going to do pre-med, like doctor. That sounds good. Like, I like caring for people. That seems like something that people would do and would lead to happiness and would definitely be far away from being a housewife.
So did you choose a school based on wanting to become a doctor, or did you like pick your school and then pick your major once you got there?
No, I didn't so much pick my school as go to the one that my parents were like very strongly encouraging me to go to, because it was a religious school. I think they felt like I would be safest there and would get the kind of worldview that they wanted me to have. And I got a full ride scholarship there. So there wasn't really a lot of arguing about it, I guess. It just kind of happened and made sense. But then once I got there, I was like, oh gosh, biology and chemistry and physics and calculus is not so much fun. So I double majored in English and journalism, almost like a hobby, like a side hustle. Cause I'm like, you know what? I love books. Reading is so fun. Like, guess what? You get to go to this class and there's like 12 books that you get to read and then you get to write reports on them. Like, how great is that?
Yes. As a recovering English major myself, I totally get where you're coming from. Yeah.
Right. Taking America cinema class, American literature, like that's just fun stuff.
So what was the experience like of attending a religious college? Like, did you enjoy it there or?
Oh, how much time do we have? I don't know if you're familiar with the term of people who are like having to deconstruct a lot of their religious upbringing and deconstruct kind of where religion ends and spirituality begins and morality and ethics. And so I would say I've spent the last 20, 25 years since I've graduated from college deconstructing like what was like, what were the great people that I met? What were the great experiences? What were the great things that I learned versus, well, that was really shitty when I was told that I need to change what I'm wearing because men might, quote unquote, stumble. And like, so I need to be responsible for them, you know, feeling a certain way. So that part wasn't great. And then obviously going back and thinking about the types of theology and the types of philosophy and how history and so many things were filtered through a particular worldview lens. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting for me to look back on that time and see the best of it, but also understand some of like the incredible brainwashing. And I think it helps me be really empathetic right now to the process of learning and unlearning. And I've brought some of that to like understanding how to approach racial issues. It's like, oh, okay, let me talk to you about this. I've had to completely unlearn like so much about spirituality and religion. It is possible. Let's kind of apply some of this unlearning to racial issues and gender issues and whatever, you know? So I guess I feel lucky or fortunate that that whole process allows me to approach other issues with some empathy and humility.
Yeah. I mean, that's, first of all, that's a wonderful optimistic view of the whole experience, because I'm sure there's another version of that that would be a lot more, why did this happen to me kind of thing. So I like your perspective on it. I think that's great.
Oh yeah. It doesn't mean that there's not like anger and resentment sometimes, for sure. Like, you know, you wish it, you could go back and have that argument that your 20-year-old self should have had.
You graduate with a degree in English and journalism?
Yes, I graduated with a degree in English and journalism and a double major in biology and a minor in chemistry.
Wow.
And I moved to DC and I started writing. I got a job working for National Journal's American Healthline. This is 1997. And they were like, there's this thing called the internet. There's hard copy newspapers that are being sent in from all over the country. You need to come in very early in the morning, clip out healthcare related articles from these hard copy newspapers. But also, here's a computer. Here's Netscape 4.6. Here's a 26K modem. Like, you're also going to surf to, you know, the local Memphis newspaper because they might have an article on healthcare that's not in the printed version. So we're going to need you to like print that out and write that up as well. We were basically like a human version of like a Google alert, I guess. and so we would write up all these stories in like a very summarizing way, and we would fax that up to the Hill before 8:30 in the morning, so it would be on Congress members' desks when they came in. And I think a month or two into the job, in addition to faxing it up to the Hill, we were emailing it up to the Hill. And then a couple months into it, we were like using very rudimentary HTML skills to put it onto a web page. I just never thought about going to med school after that, and kind of got into DC, kind of got into writing. But I think more than anything, I got into the internet and I got into this idea of communicating, but taking really long, complex issues and re-communicating them in a simple and digestible way for other people. There was something about it that I liked. I liked the deadline. I liked the rush. And it was a scrappy little place. Upstairs from me, Chuck Todd was the hotline editor. Nora O'Donnell was a staff writer. And look at where they are, and look at where I am.
Why did you end up in DC?
Originally, when I thought I wanted to go to medical school, I think I had my sights set on Johns Hopkins. And then I had an old roommate from college who lived here in DC, and she needed a roommate. And I was like, oh, DC seems close to Baltimore. DC is far away from Florida. It's far away from Georgia, where I went to school. Like, seems like a cool city. Seems kind of exciting.
So when you are exploring the internet for the first time and doing all this writing, was your job like a huge part of your life?
Yes, it was. So I mentioned the early morning deadline. Unlike every other 22-year-old in DC, I had to be up at like 5 a.m. to go to work. And so I remember at the time feeling like the job was important, but it was disruptive. You know, like I wasn't necessarily going out on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays. I was going to bed pretty early, you know, but definitely not having like the same lifestyle as like a lot of other people my age who had internships or jobs on the Hill. So I guess in that sense, it felt, yeah, it felt like a big part of my life, big part of my identity. And, you know, it was also like in my upbringing, you know, we were not economically secure. And I felt like it was a big deal that I was making $17,000 a year at my first job and had a salary and had a paycheck that came twice a month. Like that was a really big deal and felt good, even though I like still couldn't afford to live in DC. I think I did my budget once and I was like, oh, I'm spending $80 more per week than I make. Oops.
So where do you go next? Like how long were you at that job? And at what point do you decide that you need to move forward? Or do you like move up within that organization?
I was in that particular role for a couple of years. I think I just got really sick of the low pay and waking up at 5 a.m. And so there was another position editing a book about, it was like Charlie Cook's Almanac of American Politics, 1998, within the same organization, more money and like a more normal, like 9-to-5 schedule. And so that was really very enticing to me. But then that ended because he published the book and 1998 was over. And so I was like, oh, I need to get another job. I think that's when I started working for smaller agencies, doing communications, doing advocacy, kind of started as like a very low ranking account executive doing research. They're like, oh, you know how to go to the internet and write synopses and do research. We're going to hire you to do this. And then I think I just organically or naturally was put into account roles. You know, I'm organized. I can run a very good Excel spreadsheet. I think I translated my writing and communication skills more into managing the creative process and knowing how to communicate with clients and knowing how to communicate with team members. So my writing art form is just emails these days.
How did you decide to even try and pursue like the agency thing? Did somebody suggest that to you, or were you just like looking at job listings going like, I think this sort of says writing a little bit, maybe we'll try that?
Yeah. I mean, the word decide and plan are like not really a part of my vocabulary. or maybe not, like that's giving my 24-year-old self way too much credit. I just needed a job, you know? I was like, what job? You know, okay, I look like I'm qualified for this job. Is it in a cool part of the city near a metro? Check. I am there, you know? But then when I got into the agency. I was at this small agency until, like, through getting married, having my first son, and then time was just kind of up there. Like, I had gotten to a certain position where I had all of the accountability, but none of the responsibility for affecting change. And so I just felt like I was hitting my head against the wall. And then my husband, who is a recruiter, was like, I have a job for you. I think you should go talk to this PR agency. No, I'm not going to do that. He's like, no, I really think you need to talk to these people. They're talking a lot about this new thing called social media. And it really seems like they're doing something different. And, you know, they need somebody who can be an executive producer. So they need somebody who understands the creative process, and they need somebody to kind of come in and organize the production department. And I just think it'll be a really good opportunity for you. And I think also between the lines, he was probably like, I'm fucking sick of hearing you complain about your job. Please get a different one. Which, if you know Will Caggiano, kind of a theme or an undercurrent that you might hear more than once.
I was going to say, that sounds like a Will thing to say.
Yes, yeah. Yes, for sure.
So in the first agency role, before you went into the PR agency, did you feel, because you said you were there for quite some time. I mean, let's say,
I was there for probably like 7 years,
yeah.
6 or 7 years,
which
I was very loyal at that point.
In this day and age, staying anywhere for 7 years, like just physically staying anywhere for 7 years is insane, but staying at a job for 7 years is hard for people to wrap their heads around. So did you feel like you had mentorship when you were there? Any sort of guidance?
Yeah, I had a really good boss. Her name is Bethany Little. So much of what I learned from her, you know, how to manage projects, how to talk to clients, how to stick to a budget, how to manage a timeline, how to do strategy, how to write a proposal. I learned all of that from Bethany Little.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people, especially young people, don't always realize how valuable that is to be in an organization where you have that kind of mentorship, especially when you're coming up, that like, is there going to be somebody that you can look up to that you feel comfortable coming to with questions and stuff and saying like, how do I do this? Or like, can I do this better? How would you do this if you were me, kind of thing? Mm-hmm. So I always ask people if they have had the opportunity to have a mentor.
I want to say she was like the number 3 employee there. And I was probably the number 7 or 8 employee there. And then by the time I left, you know, it was 80 person company. Mm-hmm. So it gave both of us a lot of opportunity to grow with the company. But yeah, I basically kind of like followed in Bethany's footsteps in a lot of ways.
So what was it like going to work at the PR agency after that?
I definitely remember crying in the first 3 months. It was a big change. If you think about being somewhere for 7 years, you know, being somewhere from the age of, let's just say, 25 to 32, right? Like so much of my formative years were there. And then going to a really big, you know, professional PR agency. And I was in a department, like an emerging department. I was in a department that's like, we're going to do social and digital media. But then that was within a larger kind of PR machine. So I had no idea how to work with agency people, like big agency people. I had just no idea like what was coming at me. I definitely got yelled at and was made to feel very small in a lot of ways, and probably put way too much pressure on myself to be completely accomplished and perfect and know everything. And so the first year was crazy. 2-year-old, moved to a new house. I started a new job. Totally, this might be too much information, was so stressed at work and busy that I didn't take my birth control pills correctly. I think I was like chewing 4 at a time once. I was like, oh God. So then got pregnant with Cole, had him after being employed at the PR firm at Ogilvy, like within the first year. Like I think I started on January 3rd and I had him on December 27th of that same year.
Wow.
So it was a really intense 2007. A lot going on.
New job, new house, 2-year-old and pregnant through the whole thing. That sounds like, wow, please don't sign me up for that. That's a lot. It is kind of tangentially related to work, but is it hard to be a working mom and raise children in a city where you don't have family? I mean, it must be, right? Like, it must be hard.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, it's all hard, whether you have a support system or not. I wish that, like, over the years, I'm like, oh, okay. There's no such thing as balance. Like, get rid of that idea. There's choices, you know, and there's trade-offs. And like, on a given year, maybe you're going to have to put a lot more into taking care of the children. Or on a given week, you might have to give up cooking at home or seeing your husband or seeing your friends or working out because you totally want to like dig into a big project at work. What I've learned now is like, just give up the idea that you're going to hit, like, if there's 5 things that you need in life, sleep, exercise, work, friendship, family, like if those are your 5 basic needs, like if you've got like 1 or 2 on a given week, you're doing great. You're never going to have all 5, and just make sure that you're switching out from time to time. Like, overemphasize family and working out at times in your life, but don't feel bad when you have to pull back on work because you want to. And don't feel bad if you can't work out because you want to focus on your family or your job or whatever. Like, just give yourself some grace.
Do you find it to be frustrating? Because I feel like the discussion a lot, I read a lot of things on LinkedIn, especially about like women's role. Right now, the big conversation is like the toll on the caregiver as a result of the pandemic, that, you know, women have been sort of like disproportionately burdened by it and taking care of kids at home and trying to work remotely and all these other kinds of things. Do you feel like this discussion of the idea of balance, like work-life balance, is definitely a phrase that we've used on this podcast before. Like, do you think it's maybe, I don't want to say harmful, but it's just negatively impacting people to search for something that maybe doesn't exist?
Yes, I think balance is like a very elusive concept. I don't even know why people told us that like balance is even attainable and it should be something that we're striving for. Like that, yes, I think it's a very, very harmful concept. And yes, women, we are more, you know, guilt-ridden if, quote unquote, we're not balanced. Like I don't hear my husband and his friends talking about like, oh, things are so out of balance. Like I don't hear that. But I also have to shout out to Will Caggiano. We have a very, very balanced kind of workload balance, or, you know, like in terms of like the roles. I have always said that he is the chief household officer. Like every partnership needs one person who is the chief household officer, whether you're both working out of the home or not. But it's like the person who does all the worrying, you know, and thinks about the doctor's appointments and recognizes when you need to go to the grocery store. So, you know, we traded off a lot when the kids were little, but like he, I would say compared to most other men, did way more than I did for many, many years. And that's why I've been able to do so much in my career. A good husband, good partner, a great nanny, and a lot of wine.
That last one's important.
Yeah, it's probably not as healthy as the first two, but just being honest.
So you go into work at this PR firm to talk about this newfangled thing called social media. And the first year was rough because you were about to have Cole. You didn't know that, but you were about to have Cole. So then what was year two like? Like, how did that progress forward? I mean, then you've got an infant.
Yeah. So you have to realize at this time, it's early 2008. My husband is a recruiter. The Great Recession just happened. And I needed to go. We did not have a great maternity leave policy back then. But I think we like woke up one day in February and we're like, shit, there's just no money in our checking account. I better go back to work. So I went back to work probably like after 6 weeks. The second child is just a little, well, for us, it was a bit more of a relaxed of a situation than the first child because we weren't afraid of killing him. And he was also just a really good baby. And I think we, I don't know, all figured out how to coexist peacefully together. And he ate well and slept well. So I went back to work fairly early on. I mentioned having a great nanny. And my attitude was a little bit different in the sense where I was like, I gotta leave at a certain point in time. Like, I have small children at home. I got to stop caring about this. I have small children at home. I don't have time to stand around the coffee machine gossiping or shooting the shit. Like, I kind of just need to be like in and out, you know, and focused on really efficiently doing my job and we out, you know. But that attitude really helped me to develop professionally. And I think I got a lot more responsibilities and I earned a lot more respect. I wish I had those boundaries much earlier in my life. But I think you probably hear that from other people. They're like, oh, it's so weird. Like, the moment I started putting up boundaries, I started being really successful and people like trusted me more and respected me more. So yeah, that was year two.
So how long were you in that particular role?
Let's say that I was in that role for like 2 years, and then I was promoted to lead the digital department around 2009, 2010. And at that point, I was going up to New York a lot because we had American Express as a client. I was really excited to work on a brand like American Express. Oddly or ironically, we were helping them do like their first ever influencer campaign, or we didn't even call it influencers back then. It was blogger. Everything was new. Brands were doing social media and working with bloggers for the first time ever. And there was something really excited about that. And it was worth it to me to spend a day or two up in New York away from the small kids because it was really fulfilling and I had a great nanny and I had a great partner. And so I was excited about that type of brand work and helping brands really kind of understand social media. Like, corporations and brands didn't know what the hell to do with social media then. And so it was, we were all like figuring it out together. It was such a, like, now we can look back on it fondly. Like, do you remember when social media was organic, like 100% organic, and you were actually excited to look at your Facebook feed? Remember that?
I just told a cousin of mine who's 13 that I was like, back in my day, you needed a .edu email address to get a Facebook. Like, when I started college in 2005, you could only get Facebook if you were in college. And that's just mind-boggling to me now. I want to ask a question about your parents. Thinking back, what were your parents' relationships with their job? Like, did you have parents who were like, I hate my job, I just do it so that we can make enough money? Or did you have parents who were like, I'm super passionate about my job? Because I wonder how that might also like influence people when we think back to like, what did we think work was when we were younger? Did we think it was horrible? Yeah. Or did we think like, it should be your everything?
Yes, that's a good question. So my dad owned his own leather shop. It was not a job to him. I think it was everything. He saw it as his ministry. You know, he saw it as his calling. I think he would use those terms. Like, this is my calling. This is how God wants me to use my talent. He, you know, was like an artist in the sense that he made leather work and was a craftsman. owned his own leather shop. So, and my mom, you know, worked with him. And so it was like a family affair. Like, I remember there's pictures of us like in the workshop, very like 70s mode. I'm like, that was a sharp object that I was playing with. And like, that is like toxic dye. And I, like, okay, yeah. When I was really little, I think my mom and he lived at the shop. And, you know, like when I was a year old, like we all lived there. It wasn't until I was probably like 3 that we moved into a house that was separate from the leather shop. So, yeah, I think it's so much more than everything, right? It wasn't a job. It was a calling. It was all encompassing of our family's life and time and energy and what have you. Maybe I'm thinking, like, maybe this explains why I have a hard time pulling back from work sometimes.
But I also think, though, that sometimes, especially, and maybe this is like a gender bias, but I especially think it's important for young men to see strong women who are driven, because I feel like you're sort of showing them what you are establishing their normal. Like, to them, it's not abnormal for a woman to be successful and to be focused on her job, right? Whereas in the environment that you grew up in, you were told you're going to be a housewife, right? Like that your job wasn't necessarily going to be the thing that defined you, that your family and having children would be what defined you. So you have really reversed that narrative for your sons to say, like, not only can you as boys do whatever you want, but like girls also get to do whatever they want to. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, it's, yes. I think about how important it is to raise men that have really healthy gender perspectives and workforce perspectives. And it made me really happy one day when they were like, because they learned how to speak Spanish from their nanny, and they were like talking to Will, and they're like, why don't you know how to speak Spanish? Didn't your mom work and didn't you have a nanny? Like, they were like judging Will for not knowing Spanish because his mom didn't work and he didn't have a nanny. And I was like, you know what? I kind of like that. That's right.
That's hilarious. So you're doing this work where you're going to New York, and it's kind of like the beginning of what we now know as like social media marketing, right? Because that, if we're talking about like, it was all organic back then, like there was no paid media. Now everything is paid media. So I just wonder, how do you sort of ride that wave into what social media and digital marketing is now?
Well, in 2010, I spent a lot of time in Houston working for a client that was going through a bit of a crisis related to an oil spill. At that time, I learned a lot about helping corporations to be just a little bit more human and a little bit more empathetic in their communications through the lens of social media. After that, like, major assignment, it just became a thing in terms of like working with brands and corporations to, like, the world has changed and this is how people are getting their information. And do you want to show up well there, or do you not want to show up well? And like, what I do now, it's not just about social media. It's about communicating in general. And it really helps to have a good understanding and background in social media. But, you know, it's kind of like how e-newsletter, like, you can just drop, after 20 years, you can just drop the E. Like, it's just a fucking newsletter, even though it's emailed. Like, I think we're finally at the point where we're like, oh, we can drop the social and the media. Like, it's just communications. It's just marketing. Like, social media is a channel now. It's one of many channels. I don't know. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think that for a lot of people to think of trying to traverse what marketing used to be, like, let's say 20 to 25 years ago, and then be there as this thing sort of develops seemingly out of nowhere. I mean, you had the experience of working with the internet, so it doesn't seem quite so out of left field for you as maybe it did for other people. But I'm sure people who were spending a lot of time working on, you know, print-based media or working in, like, the one that I love is like people who have experience with radio marketing. Like, what are you doing with that now?
I mean, I think I was always just curious. I was very curious, like, what is the newest thing that's happening? I wanted to be where the new media was. I wanted to be a part of the next thing. Just kind of put myself in the position a lot where, you know, you're like, I'm here, you know, you're like standing there, like the whole like leaning in Sheryl Sandberg thing, like, I don't get that. But like, I was always just kind of like, I'm going to stand here when they're talking about this account or this project, almost like sidling up. And when they look around and they're like, does anybody want to work on this? I'm going to be like, yep, I'm right here. Sign me up, coach. Put me on. So I think just being curious, but really kind of putting yourself in the proximity of and being willing to be like, yeah, I want to do that. You know, I want to work on that. I'm here. I want to work on the cool thing, you know, put me in.
So what is your role within this world now?
My role within this world, besides raising a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old boys who are going to be really good men and partners.
As someone who has met your children, I can confirm that she's not just saying that because she's their mother. They are really great boys.
They know how to do laundry. They know how to do the dishes. They're learning how to cook and they're really sweet and kind. So, okay. So career-wise, I am the managing director of the Ogilvy DC office, and primarily it's like advertising, marketing, and PR. And there's 85 employees there, 85 people, friends, community.
That's awesome. Do you still feel like you have mentors in your life? And do you feel like you are a mentor to other people now?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. Like, I do have a lot of mentors in my life. I have to kind of remind myself that I do, especially during COVID. I think like all of our connections and relationships are kind of all crazy. I don't necessarily feel like talking to people a lot or texting with them or developing that relationship. Like, COVID's just enough. But whenever I feel like I don't have support or I don't have mentors, like 7 people kind of pop up and they're like, hey, remember me? I got your back. You know, I'm here for you. I'm like, oh, right. Right. It's kind of on me that I wasn't like reaching out and asking for help when I really needed it. And yeah, I'm sure I'm a mentor to a lot of people. I don't know, like, it's official, but I do spend a lot of time developing relationships with people within Ogilvy and outside of Ogilvy, and give unsolicited free advice if I'm asked, or sometimes even when I'm not asked. Like, women, let's just say women who are 10 years younger than me, I do try to talk a lot about like the idea of balance is like such bullshit. Just throw it away. Like, don't ever use the word, throw that concept out, get used to the idea that there is no such thing as balance. There can be pendulum swings and that's okay. And have a certain sense of just lean into your freedom of choice. Like, you get to choose where you want to spend your time and where you want to focus your time. Feel good about the choice and feel good about the trade-offs. Like, so I would say that's probably like one of the most important messages that I wish I had 10, 15, 20 years ago, that I try to talk to other women about.
I'm glad that that's kind of the point that you've come back to, because normally my last question is, what do you hope that someone who's listening to this takes away? And that's for sure what I hope someone who would be listening to this takes away is that balance is an illusion. Mm-hmm. But if you are, make the right choice for yourself, like that's the only thing that you can do, because you're the one who's going to have to live with it in the end. So if you choose your family, or if you choose your job, or if you choose sleeping, whatever it is that you choose, it had better be the right thing for you, because you're the one who's then going to have to go with that choice that you made.
Totally. And your choices can change every day. If you want, you can choose something for like a month or a year or 5 years. Like, you're not stuck with a certain set of priorities or a certain set of choices. Like, the other choices, like, you can literally change your mind every day if you want, or every week, in terms of where you want to put your focus or your priority. It's really kind of up to your mood and what you feel like you need at that given time. So the idea of like seasons, I think, is really important. I also feel like, along with the elusive idea of balance, is like, oh, you need to like be on this career path and you need to do this for 5 years, and if you take your eye off the ball, you'll fall behind or whatever. It's like, no, just like figure out what your season is and be okay with a long season, a short season. Like, don't feel like you have to stick with a certain path for longer than you're comfortable with. And that also helps me, you know, like sometimes I'm like, well, work is really busy for like the next 2 weeks, but I really want to go for this project, and like, it's going to be a 2 week season, you know? And so for the next 2 weeks, the next season, I am not going to be making homemade salads for everybody at night and working out. Like, there's going to be a lot of takeout Chipotle and late nights, but I am choosing this 2 week season because I want to do it.
Yeah. I think so. I guess one of the things, though, I do want to ask is, what would you say to somebody who feels like they don't have choice? Because I'm sure there must be people out there who are listening to you who are like, but I am so low on the totem pole. I don't get to decide if we have Chipotle or if I go home. Like, someone's making that decision for me. Where is my choice? Because there is choice there. It must be in there somewhere. What would you say to somebody like that?
Yes, that's true. Like, the choices that I'm talking about come out of a lot of privilege. So I think that's really important to recognize. I think also when I'm talking about choice or feeling like you don't have the luxury of making certain choices, you can decide what your priorities are. I think that you can really think about, is it more important to really focus on economic security? Or do I want to make a trade-off and have less economic security so that I can spend more time directly with my child? But, you know, you bring up a good point, Jordan. There's a lot of people who don't have that choice and they have to work 3 jobs just to buy diapers. I think that's important to recognize as well. I'm very, very privileged.
I think too, though, that you mentioned something earlier on that I think, and again, comes from a place of privilege, but I think something that is really important for people who don't think that they have choice sometimes is that part of where that comes from is people who have not yet, well, phrase it like that, who have not yet found a way to set a boundary. And so if they can say, like, listen, I'm going to work my ass off for you between 9 and 5, but at 5:01, I'm out of here because I have to go home and spend time with my family. So I will do incredible work for you, but it has to be within these set hours. I'm not looking to like go to happy hour and stuff with you all because I want to go home and see my kids. Right. And I think that that's especially not to come back to this again, but like, especially for women, I think it's hard to say no to things because you are trying to find that balance. You're that elusive balance that doesn't exist, that like, I want to be successful and I want to get promoted and I want to be recognized for the hard work that I'm doing. And so I don't want to say no, but in reality, it's like, setting boundaries is also a way to just show people who you are and say, like, these are my priorities. These are the things that are important to me, you know, whether it's going home and spending time with your family or you're, you know, taking your, you spend a lot of time in your free time, you know, volunteering or something like that, or you're, you know, after a certain certification, so you need to focus on school at night, whatever it might be, like setting that boundary is a way of showing the people that you work for and with who you really are.
Yeah. And I think it's showing yourself who you really are in terms of what your values and priorities are at that given time. Setting boundaries is so hard. I'm not gonna lie, it's really, really hard for all of us, because I think sometimes we're not even sure what our own boundaries are. What am I valuing today? You know, it's like, what am I putting in front, and then what am I putting in back? That's sometimes hard to figure out even inside of our own heads.
But like what you were saying before with choice, you can change those boundaries. You're yours. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way that you can set them up, you can take them down or move them or change them. So if you decide, okay, well, I got that certificate that I was after, and so, yeah, I can work some late evenings now because I did that thing. And so now I'm going to change my boundary. And that doesn't mean that you're caving to pressure or giving into anything. You just... life changes, you change, and therefore your boundaries and your priorities change too. So I feel like if I was going to sum this part of the conversation up, it's like, don't be afraid of change that you are in control of, because like you can always change it back if it doesn't work.
Yeah. I think we're more often than not more in control of things than we think we are.
This may have been Rachel's first ever podcast interview, but I think she nailed it, and I'm honored that she chose to have her first one with me. I'm so lucky to have women like Diane, Gia, and Rachel in my life who exemplify some of the most powerful choices we can make in our careers, in our families, in how we treat our friends, and how we give back to our communities. There's always another choice coming, and with it, a chance to do something new. This episode's guest was Rachel Caggiano, Group Managing Director, Ogilvy. If you so choose, you can check out my website, jordanrizzieri.com, or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Jordan Rizzieri. Until next time, the choice is yours. Don't Talk to Me About Work is an independent podcast. Our managing producer is Jeremy Steinkamp, and our artwork was created by Ashley Steinkamp. I'm Jordan Rizzieri, executive producer and host.